This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Your listener-sponsored community radio, 90.1 FM. $10 is going to get you in the door to hear the music of the Space City Aces and the Brad Absher Band. Once again, that's Howlin' the Heights, Sunday, September 27th from 4 to 7. Doors open at 3. Come on, get off the porch and run with the big dogs. Ow!
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Ine. Well, you got to turn on your mic in there.
I'm new to this thing. That's Brian.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we have Brian on the board tonight.
Yes, be afraid. Be very afraid.
Well, our guest tonight is John Neshman, local attorney, and we're going to be talking about Uniting American Families Act. Now, this is both as a standalone bill or what it might be part of the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill. Now, you may have heard of this before. It used to have the title Permanent Partners Immigration Act, and it would allow U.S. citizens the ability to sponsor same-sex permanent partners, just as heterosexuals do now. So it's going to be a very timely topic. This is something on the front burner of a lot of people's conversations, and it's time that we take it up and talk about it.
Yes, I also want to talk about the Houston Press has a great article. It's their cover article about the gay panic in Cowtown, and we've talked a lot about that bar raid up in Fort Worth, and we did a couple segments on it, but I think the writer really sort of paints a picture of the community, of the bar, of the TABC, of the difference between Fort Worth and some of the other cities in Texas. And we're going to try to get the author of this article on. Now, besides that story, there's also sort of a side panel that talks about Houston and why the same thing wouldn't happen. Houston, although anything can happen with TABC. But I would really recommend that you pick it up. It was out last Thursday. You can get it online. It's called Gay Panic in Cowtown, the Houston Press. Very, very good, thoughtful, long article that they do.
I haven't had a chance to read it, but that it looked good when we were talking about it before the show started. And it is something many of us don't realize that unless you're acutely aware of it, that our community here in Houston is not protected. We have no real protections at all, not even public accommodation, which means our ability and the right to go into any club, bar, whatever, in a hotel, any restaurant.
Right. The only protection that is there is there's an executive order by the mayor for city employees not to be discriminated upon. But you could still be kicked out of an apartment. You could be fired simply for being a GLBT person.
That was me.
So it does happen. It definitely does happen. So we'll see what we can do on that. Where Fort Worth is now, where were the activists and how they're getting involved in this because of what happened. So it's rather interesting. Let's see what else is going on. We're heading into the fall season here.
I know. Gosh, it just seems like where'd the year go? It's almost the ninth month, first September. Here's Labor Day coming up in 2 weeks. Jeez.
And I want to remind you that if you pledged last week to support KPFT, please do fulfill your pledge. And if you didn't pledge, you still can go online at kpft.org and make a donation, because this is the station that really needs your help. And you know, it's tough times for everybody, but it's especially tough times for public radio.
Oh, yes.
There's very, very little money that comes out of the federal government. No money comes out of the state. But most of the money that keeps the station on the air is from our wonderful listeners. And if you saw our played headphones we got here today, you'd...
Oh, yes. These are good. Thank you
yes.
for the new ones.
Yes.
I like the old ones.
Yes, although we, yes, we'll probably have to get new ones next
week.
Well,
what it is they put us on a much shorter leash.
Yes.
I can't roll my chair half a foot away from this thing. So, it'll
well,
be fun.
We got some music coming up, and then
yeah.
we'll be back with John
Well,
Mitchell.
One quick announcement.
Oh, okay.
This is the sixth week that Larry Marshall, president of the HISD School Board, has not returned my phone call.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Burn me. Love has never asked you why.
This is Queer Voices.
And welcome back. This is Jennifer Renee.
And Jack Valinsky.
And we are here visiting with John Neshman, a local attorney, as I said earlier. And we're going to talk about the Uniting American Families Act. Well, could you explain that to us? And welcome to the show tonight. So
well,
good to see you.
You
again.
It's good to be back. The Uniting American Families Act was introduced by Representative Gerald Nadler this year. It is a continuation of a bill that previously, as you said, was called the Permanent Partners Immigration Act. And what it would do is it would make the laws equal for heterosexual couples and same-sex couples. What it would do would be it would create a category called permanent partners in the immigration code so that same-sex couples could do the same thing heterosexual couples could do. They prove the permanence of their relationship, mm-hmm. and they're able, a U.S. citizen would be able to confer immigration benefits on their same-sex partner.
Well, obviously now I would assume that that's not the case and it's inequality. I mean, this sounds basically just fairness and equality for everyone. Who are the people that are saying no? I mean, instead of the usual suspects, who else could be?
Well, Ted Poe, John Culberson. Yeah, I mean, you know,
those are the usual suspects.
Yeah. Well, right now, if we look at it, 21 countries allow a mechanism for their citizens to sponsor their same-sex partners for immigration benefits. The United States is the only major Western industrialized nation in the world that does not have this.
Let's see. So the U.S. doesn't have health care for its citizens. It doesn't allow same-sex couples to be able to immigrate into the country. We also don't allow gays in the military. It seems like we're being singled out here.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Jack. And you know, the thing is that every country that's looked at this, obviously we have five countries now that recognize marriage, which I wish we would too. But of the other 16 that recognize this mechanism, they've looked at the marriage issue and they've said, still, this is a matter of fairness. Jennifer, just as you just said, it's a matter of fairness. It's looking at the circumstances and saying, these are relationships that should be valued. And so countries like Brazil and Israel and Australia and New Zealand and pretty much all of Western Europe.
And these countries don't necessarily recognize gay marriage?
Exactly. I mean, the countries I just mentioned don't.
But they recognize the same-sex partners.
Mm-hmm. They've had the same go-around as we have. And the reason why this piece of legislation exists is because we have this horrendous statute called the Defense of Marriage Act, as
right.
you know.
DOMA, so, for y'all out there.
Exactly. And so for federal purposes, for federal law purposes, we have no recognition of our relationships in federal law, for at least looking at it like a marriage. And so under that circumstance, what the Uniting American Families Act would be, it's a go-around around DOMA. It recognizes the existence of it, which to me has always been a problem I've had with this entire circumstance,
okay.
too. But it would correct the unfairness that exists now and the fact that so many couples face breakup. They face the end of their relationships and forced leaving from the United States because of the way the laws are now.
But isn't that just what the opposition to it want? They don't even recognize us as citizens.
We have a problem with this legislation that, one, it deals with immigration, and two,
right.
it deals with gay people, right? And so we fight definitely with this legislation because of two problems that always come up. But that has not stopped this legislation from achieving, at this point, unprecedented support. And for the first time this year in the Senate, they had hearings on this issue. Patrick
That's amazing,
Leahy,
yeah.
You know, Patrick Leahy is our Senate supporter for the Uniting American Families Act. And they had hearings this year, very, very excellent hearings a few months ago. And there is real chances for the first time that this could be legislation, whether it stand alone, probably not, but as part of a larger comprehensive immigration plan, there are real opportunities now and real possibilities.
Well, speaking of that, I think I read recently that Obama's putting the entire immigration reform up till next year.
That's true. That's true, and he's facing his problems now, no question
Certainly.
About it. I mean, health care is something he has placed more of a premium on a few other issues. Obviously, the economy is something that has taken much time from the administration as well. However, Obama himself has spoken, his own words have been that he supports the rights of U.S. citizens to be able to sponsor their same-sex partners in the United States. And we want to hold his feet to the fire on this, not just his, but also the representatives who, you know, claim that they have 100% ratings from HRC, for example. This is one of the pieces of legislation that HRC supports. And so we want to make sure that an Al Green and a Gene Green in this area join with Sheila Jackson Lee, one of only two supporters of this legislation in the state of Texas, and come forth and show themselves as supporters of this legislation.
And I don't expect either senator from Texas would be supporting this.
Not the current ones.
In the case of the same sex, aren't there ways around it? It would see, can't you sponsor individuals, period?
You can't, not in the United States.
So we could. So if I had a friend, maybe who moved away or who I knew as an exchange student, they moved away, I can't sponsor them into the United States.
Almost in 99.9% of the circumstances, no. If your friend won a Nobel Peace Prize, yeah, maybe.
Well, and there was some talk about some people marrying somebody just to get into the country.
Yeah.
And that is first of all, it's not legal. Second of all, they really check up on that now, don't they?
There are enormous investigations on cases like that. And I mean, the only thing I could tell someone like that is I absolutely understand their motivation for doing it. I absolutely do. My partner and I waited 13 years for him to get permanent residence. We probably spent over $100,000 on legal fees and out-of-state tuition fees at the University of Houston, changing his degree plan and having to send him to Columbia to constantly get his OKs on visas when sometimes they threatened to cancel it on numerous occasions. It was pure nightmare. 13 years and he finally got his permanent residence. But for most couples, they can't do that. And so they look to options such as that. And all I can tell them is don't do it because the law is so severe. You face up to a $250,000 fine and up to a 10-year stay in a federal pen plus a lifetime bar to ever come back to the United States if you're found guilty of that. So, you know, I mean, we often can find ways around that if we can, you know, find the circumstances of the person. But we're fighting for this legislation because it would make this fair for those people. It would make the same thing fair for any of us who fall in love with someone when we don't ask them what their visa status is when we fall in love with them. Mm-hmm. We fall in love with them. And can you imagine a government that tries to break a relationship apart, that tries to tell two people that you can't stay together. We just aren't going to allow you to do it because you are two women or you are two men. I can't imagine that. We're going to change that here in the United States.
Well, that's again, I am always been a firm believer, maybe naively, that as a whole, the American people are fair-minded. And if presented in a fair-minded way, then it does make sense. Yeah. It does touch that part of all of us who want to have someone to love and want someone to love us, mm-hmm. and we want to be together. It's unfortunate that it's filled, that, you know, the airwaves are filled with a lot of lies behind it all.
Another issue is people coming to this country who are HIV positive just mm-hmm. to visit. And under the Bush administration, I guess a lot of people probably were able to not declare that and get in for visiting, for conferences. I mean, there was even the AIDS conference here in the United States mm-hmm. Where apparently they dropped that temporarily. So where does that stand?
Well, actually, the International AIDS Conference, last held in Oakland back in 88, I think it was. Yeah, that's the last time the biggest conference on HIV has taken place in the United States. And since then, the International Conference on AIDS has basically said, we won't go back to the United States because you are one of 12 countries in the world that will not let people in because of their HIV status.
Just to visit.
Just to visit, just to live here permanently. There are two bans in effect. Now, last year, there was a lot of hoopla about the fact that Bush signed the reinstatement of PEPFAR, which included taking this ban off of the books in the immigration code. But it existed in two places. It existed in the code, and that's gone, thankfully, because it was the only disease specifically mentioned in the immigration code as a basis to deny people entry. Mm-hmm. But it also existed on the list of the Department of Health and Human Services as a disease of public health significance. It's still there now. And we're fighting that issue through many organizations, our office, Immigration Equality in New York. We're trying to make sure that comes off the books because that needs to happen. I mean, the list of 12 countries is the most horrendous list you can imagine, and we're on it, and that should embarrass anybody as an American, that we're one of the countries that keeps people with HIV from coming in here as visitors and also as permanent residents.
Does that even include transferring planes in the U.S.?
It could. It definitely could. You are not allowed to enter the United States unless you are a citizen of the U.S. if you have HIV. You're inadmissible to the United States.
That doesn't make any sense.
And that was a good pause there because, I mean, it should. That's pensive. It's like it's unbelievable because the other countries are Sudan, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, the axis of terror, you know, and we're on it. And you know, China was on that list. And before the Olympics last year, they changed their law because they said, we don't want to be embarrassed by being on this list of countries that precludes admission of people with HIV.
Obviously, there are people in the United States that don't mind being embarrassed and being included with North Korea and the Sudan and a lot of other places that have horrendous social and civil liberty issues on many areas. One question that always intrigues me about the immigration laws and all is that being a native-born citizen, we just really don't understand what it takes for someone just to come visit. Because a lot of times in my own limited travels, I never had to have a visa. I've never had that. You know, the American passport was like a, you know, get out of jail free card, a free pass to almost anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And it's hard for us to understand. So I'm sure a lot of people out there don't understand what it does take for someone just to come visit or to come and work here legally.
Well, isn't it also the fact that there's comparatively, percentage-wise, less people from the United States travel outside their country than a lot of other major countries. Of course, it's easier in Europe because it's like a next state over, of course. But yeah. And the EU sort of allows people, and people speak more languages over there.
Well, you're both correct. But, you know, the circumstance is that if you come from Western Europe, you can come to the United States without a visa, and it's very easy to do so. Many other countries, Argentina, Japan, there are other countries that do not even have to get a visa to come for short 90-day stays. But, you know, my partner, Ricardo, he's from Colombia, and he now is an HISD teacher. He is one of the finest teachers HISD has ever known. He's won every award you can imagine, bilingual teacher of the year, teacher of the year. Well, when we were together, we made a trip out to visit my father in Costa Rica where he was living. We came back to the U.S., and he was stopped at the immigration when we came through immigration. They told me I could not stay with him. I could not even be there with him. They told me, they said, get lost. You're not even allowed here. They took him back to secondary questioning and kept him there for an hour. Can you imagine a government that keeps your partner from you and says, and you can't do anything about it? That was the most frightening hour of my life. I can tell you that I will never forget how horrifying it was to sit there for an hour wondering if my partner was ever going to come through customs. He had an absolutely valid tourist visa at the time. But, you know, it didn't matter to me. I didn't fall in love with him because of his visa status. If he'd been illegal, I'd have fallen in love with him. But he was always legal, you know. We went through hell to get his green card, and we're the lucky ones. He got it. We got to spend $100,000 in fees and lawyer fees and everything else. But we're lucky because he got it. How many others of the 36,000 couples in this country who are just like us don't get their visa? And they're not lucky like us. And they face that time where they either have to leave the country or they go illegal, right? And then have to deal with that now, as we know how many people have to deal with that now. So from an angle of that, this is an enormously important issue. It's an issue that affects everybody in this community, especially in a city as international as Houston. So I'm real thankful you are dealing with this tonight.
Oh, absolutely. And something you said that struck a chord, and that was, you know, he's fortunate that, you know, he's a good teacher, award-winning in teacher. But the truth is, HISD has no non-discrimination.
That's true.
For sexual orientation or gender identity. So he could be terrorized by another teacher just because he didn't like him. Or jealous
or
of him.
Or a parent.
Yeah. Or anyone else.
Absolutely.
And it's a shame that HISD just has ignored that issue.
And I don't know.
Especially if they've got as many as I've already done the research on, and you and I were talking before, a lot of GLBT teachers are in HISD.
And a lot
and
of them
still need more teachers.
And a lot of them were foreign-born and who ended up getting their permanent residence, like Ricardo, through HISD. Thankfully for that. And they have all, to a T, I don't even know an exception to this rule, who hasn't gone on to be one of the best teachers HISD has. You know, and so, yeah, I mean, you know, and that could be for any group. You know,
and isn't there an awful lot, I mean, we don't know that for sure, but serve in the military that are foreign-born.
Absolutely.
And they're probably GLBT, but of course they can't say that in the military.
Absolutely. The military operates under a totally different code than we operate outside of the military. And so there are many rules that affect people in the military that don't affect the rest of us.
Well, what can we do to help?
Well, the organization, the only national organization that works on behalf of GLBT immigration and makes that their primary focus is a group in New York. I used to chair the group. It's called Immigration Equality. And if you just type www.immigrationequality.org, you will go to their website. Please donate generously to this group. I mean, when you look at how much they're working on, and it's not just on the issue of the Uniting American Families Act, which we literally form the legislation that is now working its way through Congress. It's also asylum cases. People who are coming from countries where they can be killed, where they can be tortured, where they're persecuted because they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, HIV positive. Those are cases, nobody works more on those cases than Immigration Equality does. On the HIV ban, no other organization has put more into getting rid of this horrendous ban than Immigration Equality. Those are just three primary issues. The issue of transgender issues, the issue of changing, for example, your passport, getting a passport to reflect, you know, the corrected gender of an individual. Nobody's doing more than Immigration Equality.
Well, and currently the Homeland Security has changed, and the Transportation Safety Board, I'm trying to remember the exact one, that now, it's horrendous for transgender people, because if you're in transition, all of your due to the current laws, some of your documentation can't be changed until you actually have the reassignment surgery.
Sure.
And then some states, even after the reassignment surgery, they won't allow you to change your documentation, but yet your documentation to get on an airplane has to reflect who you are.
And Jennifer, just if you had been, if in a circumstance, if you had married a foreign national a couple years ago, immigration under Tom Ridge at the time issued a memo that literally said, well, because you married someone who is of, we don't know whether they're opposite sex or same sex, because there's no definition of sex in the immigration code, you would have been precluded from conferring immigration benefits on anybody, no matter who you married. But Immigration Equality and a couple of other organizations as well worked on that issue to change the immigration policy to allow for transgender people, in essence, to be able to confer immigration benefits as well.
And you know, that this is it turns into just a ball of twine going so many different directions, and so confusing about different areas of the government having their own privy over certain aspects, just as you were talking about earlier, that as far as Health and Human Services, even though the other portion had been relieved. But, you know, it's a shame that there's that much that the government is confused itself.
Totally confused.
Which only means that an active group has to be there advocate the what's best. You know.
You can get more information about John Etchman from our website, queervoices.org, and his law firm, Canteen and Etchman. And thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Anytime.
Thank you.
I'm thrilled to be here.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Why are there gay people? Do gay people carry a different consciousness than straight people do? And if that is true, which I think it is, and Harry thought it was, what is our contribution to society from that place of gay spirit, gay consciousness? We're not a sexual act per se. There's something else that we're doing in society that allows us to remain generation after generation after generation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A global rights group details Iraq's anti-gay slaughter, evangelical Lutherans' blessed partnered gay clergy, and the Radical Fairies Manifesto explores queer consciousness. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
And I'm Michelle Pleasant with News Wrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 22nd, 2009. A report issued by the international advocacy group Human Rights Watch this week, detailing horrific acts against gays in Iraq, has finally prompted corporate media attention. LGBT outlets have for many weeks been reporting on an intensive sexual cleansing campaign of abductions, torture, beatings, and murder carried out against gay men, or those perceived to be, by Muslim fundamentalist-backed militia in the U.S.-occupied country. Titled, They Want Us Exterminated, Murder, Torture, Sexual Orientation, and Gender in Iraq. The 67-page report is based on recent interviews conducted by a Human Rights Watch team in Iraq with more than 50 men who identified as gay, as well as with doctors, journalists, and United Nations officials. It confirms the deaths of hundreds of Iraqi sexual and gender-variant men in the wake of the security chaos created by the U.S. invasion and occupation. The report includes heart-wrenching interviews with gay Iraqis describing, sometimes in horrifying detail, the abuses they've suffered or witnessed. It said doctors confirmed earlier accounts of men being killed by having their anuses glued shut before being force-fed laxatives, causing painful and slow death.
The militiamen invade homes, abduct men without warning, and interrogate and brutalize them to get names of other people suspected of being gay. Mutilated bodies are then often left in garbage dumps or on a road in the neighborhood the next day. Some corpses have been found with the word puppy, an Iraqi slang word equivalent to faggot, on placards or carved onto their bodies. Many believe that Iraqi officials know about the murders but are doing little to stop them. The country's human rights minister told the Washington Post this week that the closeted nature of Iraq's gays makes it hard to protect them. Openly gay U.S. Congressman Jared Polis of Colorado expressed deep concerns about the butchery to U.S. officials in Baghdad during a visit there in April, but there's been no reported response by the Obama administration. Perhaps the most disturbing aspect of the campaign, the Human Rights Watch report says, is its publicity and impunity. The death squads treat murder as a message aimed at other presumed deviants and at the population at large. As one man told us, it is a slaughterhouse on the streets. Human Rights Watch LGBT rights program director Scott Long said that the violence has subsided a bit in recent weeks, partly because many gay men have gone deep underground. Another reason, he said, is that the militias have run out of people to kill.
An ultra-Orthodox Jewish website in Israel posted a letter this week calling for criminal prosecution of the managers of Tel Aviv's LGBT center. A murderous assault on a youth group meeting at the center on the evening of August 1st left 2 dead and at least 10 injured. The posting on the ultra-Orthodox Haredi website Zofer said center officials should be charged with child sexual abuse and that many citizens are sick of this depraved behavior that lacks any moral boundaries. The motive of the masked gunman who indiscriminately sprayed the center's youth group meeting with bullets is still not known, and he remains at large. A number of activists have blamed ultra-Orthodox Jewish clerics and some ministers in the coalition government for fueling the violence by relentlessly railing against homosexuality and calling gays and lesbians child molesters. In the wake of the Tel Aviv tragedy, the LGBT center in Jerusalem, which has in the past felt the brunt of Israel's homophobic violence, this week hired an armed security guard for the first time. Jerusalem Open House officials said they're taking other security precautions.
But the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or ELCA, voted this week to welcome same-gender partnered clergy. Previous policy had allowed only celibate gay pastors. Heterosexual pastors are also expected to remain celibate until they marry. By a vote of 559 to 441, the ELCA National Assembly, meeting in Minneapolis, approved a resolution to permit pastors in accountable, lifelong, monogamous, same-gender relationships to serve as rostered leaders of this church. The Assembly earlier voted 619 to 402 to allow its churches to conduct ceremonies of their choosing to recognize same-gender couples, although marriage is still not an option. A number of clergy and other speakers during an emotional day-long debate inferred or stated directly that their congregation would leave the 4.5 million-member denomination, the largest Lutheran church in the U.S., if it welcomed gays and lesbians in these ways. The Assembly still has to approve procedural changes to allow the resolutions to go forward, which officials said would be in place by 2010. The move follows the lifting in July of a temporary ban by the Episcopal Church on the consecration of partnered openly gay bishops. The U.S. branch of the Anglican Communion is also in the process of developing official liturgies to bless same-gender unions. Both actions have driven traditionalist Episcopal congregations to leave the church and seriously strained Episcopal ties with several conservative regions of the global Christian denomination.
Anti-gay actions by the 13 million-member Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormons, have also become a lightning rod for LGBT activism. A gay male couple who kissed on the church-owned public walkway outside the temple headquarters in Salt Lake City, Utah, in July, were accosted by security guards and arrested for trespassing, although city prosecutors dropped those charges. The Salt Lake City incident and a similar confrontation in El Paso, Texas, prompted online bloggers to call for a great nationwide kiss-in on August 15th. Couples of all sexual orientations defiantly but peacefully demonstrated their support for public affection in several U.S. and Canadian cities. About 200 people filled a downtown amphitheater in Salt Lake City, while about 50 people gathered for a five-minute kiss-in at Piedmont Park in downtown Atlanta. A few kissing couples braved the scorching sun on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., with placards that read, "Equal Opportunity Kisser" and "A Kiss Is Not a Crime." A lesbian couple was asked to leave a diner in Silver Spring, Maryland this week for displaying affection for one another, prompting a kiss-in protest by about a dozen couples a few days later. As in other incidents, restaurant management claimed the two were doing more than just kissing.
The Mormon Church was also a major funder and supporter of Proposition 8 in California, which last November overturned a state Supreme Court marriage equality ruling. There were developments this week in a high-profile federal lawsuit challenging the validity under the U.S. Constitution of barring same-gender couples from marrying. Ted Olson and David Boies, who opposed each other in the Bush versus Gore election case before the U.S. Supreme Court, filed the suit in May on behalf of two same-gender California couples who were denied marriage licenses because of Proposition 8. Vaughn R. Walker, Chief Justice of the U.S. District Court for Northern California, scheduled a trial date of January 11th. He also denied a motion by the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Lambda Legal, and the American Civil Liberties Union to join the plaintiffs in the case. Their attorneys had successfully argued the marriage equality case before the state high court. The judge also rejected a motion by the conservative Campaign for California Families to join the defense of the marriage ban. He'd already allowed the Alliance Defense Fund, a right-wing legal organization, to intervene in the defense of Proposition 8. The judge did allow the city and county of San Francisco to join the case, but only to offer information about Proposition 8's impact on local government. Olson and Boies had argued that intervention by other parties would unnecessarily slow the legal process, and Walker seems intent on a speedy trial. The case is eventually expected to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Meanwhile, Anchorage, Alaska Mayor Dan Sullivan this week vetoed an ordinance to ban discrimination against LGBT people in employment, credit, public accommodations, and housing. Churches and other religious institutions would have been exempt. Sullivan said he did not believe that pervasive discrimination existed in his city. The Anchorage Assembly approved the bill last week by a vote of 7-4, but 8 votes are needed to override the veto. Equality activists have battled for decades to get an anti-bias ordinance enacted in Anchorage. The first lesbian gay rights ordinance passed the assembly in 1976, but it was vetoed by then-Mayor George Sullivan, the father of the current mayor. Local observers don't believe the assembly will muster the votes for an override this time either.
City commissioners in Kalamazoo, Michigan, voted earlier this month to put a similar anti-bias ordinance they had approved in July before the voters in November. Officials verified the required number of signatures on a petition by opponents to overturn the measure and put the issue on the ballot. Enforcement of the ordinance was suspended pending the outcome of the November vote.
But finally, a court in Poland has ordered a woman to pay her gay neighbor the equivalent of $5,200 for repeatedly calling him a pedal, Polish slang for faggot in public. The court decided that her continued verbal assaults injured Ryszard Gierz' dignity and privacy. Gierz, his partner Tomasz, and the woman, identified only as Anna S., live in the small northwestern town of Wolin. The woman, who maintains her innocence, said she may appeal the verdict. The Polish organization Campaign Against Homophobia said the case represented the first time a gay person had pursued his or her rights so openly in the country's court system.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 22, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Michelle Pleasant.
We'll celebrate the 30th anniversary of a queer cabal that discovered that the political can be magical. But long before they came along, a culture and spirituality that they would come to emulate was revealed by a remarkable lesbian.
Alice Fletcher walks among the Indians, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Alice Fletcher was born in Cuba in 1838, later moving to Brooklyn, New York with her family. Once grown, she was a teacher for a while and then received informal anthropological training. While single and 40 and without any knowledge of Native American language, she began research and arranged to live with the Omaha Indians of Nebraska to learn their way of life. During the next four decades, she recorded and published accounts of their rituals, music, dance, and social life, and collected artifacts for the Peabody Museum. She was assisted by Jane Gay, her lifelong companion, and her own informally adopted Native American son, Francis LaFleche. Upon Alice's death at age 85, she left behind a treasure trove of professional writings, but unfortunately had destroyed her most personal papers. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Tall Feathers.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org.
The demonstrations have been organized, after the ballots have been cast, after the checks have been written, what more is there to gay liberation? On the first weekend of September in 1979, a small network of movement veterans led a gathering that began to explore and celebrate the uniqueness of gay consciousness. This Way Out correspondent Charlie Lang talked with Don Kilhefner and Mark Thompson, two of the very first radical fairies.
Cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle.
How did the radical fairies come into being?
Back in 1978, Harry Hay and I met out in San Juan Pueblo.
in Mexico, where he was living. And both of us were concerned about the direction that the gay liberation movement was taking. It was becoming more bourgeois. It was becoming more conventional politics. It was becoming more gay assimilationist. And we felt that there was a need for something in the movement at that time that deepened our understanding of gay consciousness and gay spirituality. And so the Radical Fairies came out of that kind of understanding.
I noticed on the poster from the original gathering that it was called, actually, a spiritual conference. Can you speak a little bit more to the aspect of spirituality?
Well, both Harry and I felt strongly that one of the things that was missing from the movement at that time was an understanding of the purpose of gay people. Why are there gay people? Do gay people carry a different consciousness than straight people do? And if that is true, which I think it is, and Harry thought it was, what is our contribution to society from that place of gay spirit, gay consciousness? And so that was woven right into the conference. The subtitle of the conference was, What is the Gay Dimension of Spirituality? What is the Spiritual Dimension of Being Gay?
Any answers to those questions?
Well, Harry has come up with his understanding what he calls subject-subject consciousness. That one of the ways that we differ from straight people is that we carry a subject-subject consciousness, same with same, while heterosexual carry a subject-object consciousness. And therefore, the way we walk in the world, the way we manifest ourselves in the world will be different. Walt Whitman also came up with there's a difference between gay men that he called adhesive and straight people, which he called amative. Edward Carpenter, an English socialist, one of the great pioneers of gay liberation, came up with the idea that gay people play certain kinds of social roles in society. Evolutionary biologists are telling us the same thing. E.O. Wilson at Harvard is saying gay people carry the rare altruistic impulse in our species, etc. So there's a lot of accumulating information that says they got it all wrong. We're not a sexual act per se. There's something else that we're doing in society that allows us to remain generation after generation after generation. And the Radical Fairies were called together for us to begin talking about deepening and broadening what gay liberation was all about.
So I'm thinking 1979, long before the advent of online connections of any kind, how did you go about gathering these men at that time for the first conference?
Well, it was difficult, let me tell you. We had to find a place because we wanted a place where it would just be gay men. We didn't want anybody else around, and that's hard to find these days. And we finally ended up at a place out in the Sonora Desert of Arizona, east of Tucson, called the Sri Ram Ashram, run by a gay man. And Harry and I went out there, scouted it out, and said, yes, this is the place. It is isolated enough. The nearest neighbors were miles and miles away. It had a pool. It had a commercial kitchen. It had places where people could sleep. That was the place. Then we had to reach people.
Yeah.
And one of the ways we reached them, thank God for Mark Thompson, Mark came and did an interview with Harry, and during that interview talked about the gathering, and Mark's article kind of got that out to the rest of the world. And we then also did a historic leaflet, which also on one side talked about the gathering, on the other side kind of talked about the purpose of the gathering, why we're calling gay men together.
That place had scorpions too, Don.
And rattlesnakes.
They didn't tell you about that.
No.
Mark, at the time you were working at the Advocate,
yes,
correct?
I was just a young gay man living in San Francisco in 1979. I was 27 years old and had already been working for the Advocate for 4 years and was doing lots of cover articles. And I was aware of the writings of Edward Carpenter and Harry Hay from other sources. I felt that I've always been kind of on a spiritual seeker's path. And 1978 was important for a lot of reasons, because, of course, that was the year that Harvey Milk was, put into political office. And it seemed to be a benchmark for our community. On one level, it was. And on another level, it seemed like nothing was really happening. I mean, we were getting political gains, but I felt very deeply that we gay men were kind of in a stuck place spiritually, that we were still using each other and going about our business in familiar old ways, and that we needed a new approach. So when we had the opportunity to fly down and interview Harry, so I did this long interview with Harry about his ideas, these seminal ideas. And at the end of the article, I concluded with all of the information about how you could find this very remote place in the middle of the Arizona desert.
So can you give us a little bit of a context, like how many men showed up and from where?
About 150 gay men showed up.
Wow.
And the great thing was they came from all over North America. Every city was represented. Toronto, Vancouver, San Francisco, New Orleans, Miami. And there were two or three ferries from each one of these places. And after the gathering was over, they went back and seeded ferry gatherings in their own cities. So very quickly, the radical ferries became a decentralized kind of operation, with ferry gatherings happening almost everywhere.
And at the conference, was there a structure per se, or was it kind of made up as you went along?
It was both structured and unstructured. We wanted to, each day had a structure to it. It began with a great ferry circle where we all got together and talked and shared. And then throughout the different days, there were different things that people wanted to do. Somebody wanted to do a workshop on tantric spirituality, gay tantric spirituality. Somebody else wanted to do something on erotic massage around the pool. Somebody wanted to do, and so people brought their gifts to this gathering, and all of those gifts were woven in to the fabric of what the gathering became. Each day also had a focus to it. And by the end of the gathering, there was a great circle called, and a ritual in that great circle, which was created by the people who were at the gathering. It was not predetermined, but people wove that ceremony together. So it was a very deep, powerful gathering of gay men, where the creativity created the gathering. There was a structure, but it was a loose structure.
I'll never, ever forget that last gathering, because there we were in the moonlight doing our evocations to the four spirits and to the sky and to the Mother Earth and to each other. And all of a sudden, on the outskirts of the circle, we could see this enormous horned bull just appear as if out of nowhere.
Wow.
And it just standing there, just looking at us, and then just kind of disappearing. Things like this happened all the time. And don't forget the famous mud ritual that happened on the second day. I think it was John Burnside, Harry Hayes' partner, and others said, well, all this talk and everything is fine, but we've got all this reddish earth, you know. So they found like a little gully not far from the encampment and did a bucket brigade and made this enormous pit of this beautiful, silky mud. And everyone just stripped and adorned themselves with the mud, put bits of chaparral in their hair, and just did this big clump of a muddy gay man. It was a sight to behold.
It really was.
This is Charlie Lang. I'm speaking with Don Kilhefner and Mark Thompson about the radical fairies. So, Don, have these gatherings continued to occur consistently?
Continue to occur around the world.
Around the world.
All over the United States. There are Euro fairies that meet several places, several times a year. A residential fairy sanctuary just opened in eastern France.
A residential fairy sanctuary. So it's not just like a weekend fairy gathering. This is a facility where
fairies... A place where radical fairies live, farm the land, have a relationship to nature, invite people in for gatherings periodically, and it's a place where a core group of fairies live. And other fairies or other gay men who are in need of some loving care, loving kindness, just getting away from the rush of things, can go and stay a week, can stay a month, can stay a year.
Don, I'm wondering what relevance do the radical fairies hold for gay men today?
I think there are three major ways in which the radical fairies are relevant today. One of them is that they represent progressive politics. We have very little in the way of progressive politics, organized progressive politics in the gay community today. Radical fairies work to increase, to broaden political and social consciousness in our community, supporting liberation movements of women and men, people of color, working people, ordinary people like us, support political candidates that have some kind of integrity and ethics to them, so that we're involved in progressive politics. Radical fairies are relevant today because it focuses on gay-centered consciousness. It focuses on those questions of who are we, not the assimilation into the mainstream, but why are there gay people here? Why haven't gay people gone down the drainpipe of history? What are we contributing to society? So that kind of exploration, which I think young people are hungry for, particularly after the decades of empty calories of right-wing assimilationist politics in our community. And I think a third way that's relevant today is around community building. The Radical Fairies put a great deal of emphasis on creating community, healthy community, community in which we can be openly gay, community in which we honor ancestors, requires elders. There are adults and youth working together, a community that has consciousness around the environment, a community that conducts ceremonies and rituals that keeps our community sane and healthy. Those are all questions that I think young people are hungry for today. So I think what we're going to see is a wave of radical fairy consciousness coming into the community. The reality is gay liberation is a revolutionary movement. It wasn't a middle-class law reform movement. It was a revolutionary movement based on liberation. We liberate ourselves. We're not asking for emancipation. We liberate ourselves. And along with that liberation movement came a liberation consciousness, creating a community, creating a reality for us that makes sense to us, not fitting in to that larger community. And the radical fairies are the contemporary extension of that. It probably is the most vibrant grassroots gay effort in the world right now.
Well, and on that note, I want to thank you both for your rich conversation. This is Charlie Lang, and I've been speaking with Don Kilhefner and Mark Thompson about the wonderful radical fairy movement in the United States and around the world for the last 30 years.
Dear friends, queer friends, let me tell you how I am feeling. You have given me such pleasure, I love you so. Dear friends, queer friends, let me tell you how I am feeling. You have given me such pleasure, I love you so. I love you so. I love you so. I love you so.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Lee Moore, Michelle Pleasant, Rex Wachner with Bill Kelly, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Tall Feathers, and Sir Ian McKellen contributed program material. Steve Pride produced Charlie Lang's Radical Fairies feature, which we introduced with an instrumental excerpt from Burning Times by Charlie Murphy, with thanks to J.D. Doyle. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WVEW, Brattleboro, Vermont, 2NUR, Newcastle, New South Wales, KAZU, Pacific Grove, California, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. For the 1,117th time, do stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
In keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
Hello, my name is Robert Mark, and I am a candidate for the KPFT Pacifica local station board. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri before moving to Texas, where community-based talk radio was invented by a gentleman by the name of Robert Hyland back in the 1950s. I love radio, and I love locally produced community service radio, networking with organizations to further the mutual aims of the station and those organizations. And I would appreciate your vote for the local station board.
That was a statement by
by Robert Mark. For complete candidate statements and more information about all of your candidates for the local station board, please visit kpft.org. The future of KPFT and the entire Pacifica network now rests upon the participation of our listener members. Let your voice be heard with your vote. This is KPFT Houston.
DIA presents Connect and Communicate, a seminar for South Asian teens, young adults, and parents on forming healthy relationships on Saturday, August 29th, 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at University Center, University of Houston, main campus. Presenters include professionals from Child Builders, a Houston organization promoting positive social and emotional development in children, Montgomery Counters Women's Center, and Saheli Austin. The highlight of the seminar will be an interactive theater performance by Gita Kaulagi and Voices Against Violence, UT Austin. The group will demonstrate the day's themes, such as communication techniques, overt and covert messages, power and control issues affecting relationships, cultural conflicts, and stereotypes and biases. For information on community events, visit KPFT's events calendar at kpft.org. KPFT Houston.
In the midst of
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT. And the song I open with is by one of my favorite bands, Pansy Division. It's from their first album from 1993 called Undressed, and the song is Femme in a Black Leather Jacket. I'm very pleased this month because I get to share with you a special interview I did with John Cinoli, the founder of Pansy Division. And he's been very busy lately. The band has just released their 9th full-length album, and it's called That's So Gay. And a new documentary has been hitting the film festival circuit called Pansy Division, Life in a Gay Rock Band. That's out on DVD now. And John's written a book called Deflowered, My Life in Pansy Division. So he's been traveling the country on a book tour. I'm very glad he stopped in Houston, as he was able to come by for an extensive interview. Let me tell you how this show will be set up. my interview with John will be split into two parts, with a lot of it being in part one, the segment designed for broadcast radio. But if you know anything about this band at all, you already know that most of the joy of their music comes from the boundaries they've always gleefully leaped over. Their music celebrates gay sexuality, and they were one of the first to do so with such explicit lyrics. Many of their songs, well, I can't even read the titles on this show. That's where part two will come in. That can be found on my website as an internet-only version. Of course, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. But wait, there's more. In preparation of this show, I also decided that on QMH, I've never really done justice to the punk music genre of queercore. And the main reason why is the same one that's prevented me from playing very many Pansy Division songs over the years. It's the lyrics, folks. So as long as I'm extending this show to the internet, I'm going to attempt the very daunting task of covering the genre of queercore, focusing mostly on the early 90s. I'll finally play such bands as Team Dresch, Tribe 8, Fifth Column, Go, God Is My Co-Pilot, Fag Bash, and on, about 5 hours worth. And if you've ever dug into queercore at all, you've heard of JD's Top 10 Homocore Hits. You'll hear about that as well, because in this special segment, I have a very interesting interview with G.B. Jones, who is credited with being one of the first influences on queercore, both for her work with the fanzine JD's and in the band Fifth Column. So hold on to your seatbelts when you visit those segments. But let's get started with my John Ginoli interview. Pansy Division was not John's first band. For several years in the mid-80s, John led a band called The Outnumbered.
I had wanted to be in a band, have a band, since I was a kid. So throughout college, I had the idea of wanting to do a band. And as college was finishing up, I finally started writing songs, and I think I was 20, I started playing guitar and writing songs. So The Outnumbered was my first band, with, you know, all the ideas of my childhood, my youth, building up, thinking, you know, what would I finally do if I got to have a band? So that was my first band. We're in Champaign, Illinois, and the band was successful. We were together 5 years. We made 3 albums and a single. We played over 200 shows and went all over the country. The Outnumbered was, you know, started when I was 22 years old, and it broke up when I was 27. And I just listened to a lot of The Outnumbered's music again recently and just thought, wow, this is the music of a disillusioned young man who just got out of college. It's the Reagan era, and things pretty much seemed to suck. I was working at Kinko's. I wanted to try to play music. The music scene just seemed, you know, mainstream music scene just seemed really dispiriting, really horrible. So I thought, well, I guess I'm just, you know, an outcast, and here's me doing my music, and I'm just going to do it the way I want it to.
I want to stop and ask about one of the songs by The Outnumbered called I Feel So Sorry Now.
Yeah. That was actually the first really good song I wrote. And it really wasn't about anybody in particular. It was just thinking about various things. Thinking about what a relationship would be like and a situation I might find myself in. But it really wasn't written from experience.
Was that the basis for Homo Christmas?
A variation of that is what I used for the music for Homo Christmas, yes. Because I wrote Homo Christmas in a hurry, and it was right before Christmas of 91. And we were going to play a show. It was the week before Christmas, and that afternoon I decided I wanted to write a Christmas song just for the show. And it turned out to be a really good song, but I stole from myself to get the music in a hurry because I had to do it right then.
We'll hear Homo Christmas on part two of this interview. But here's a bit of the song it grew from, I Feel So Sorry Now.
I was ready to commit myself to loving you. I knew it wouldn't be easy.
The band Outnumbered released three albums. That was from their first, from 1985, called Why Are All the Good People Going Crazy? I know this is a very well-known fact, but this is a history show. I can't not ask how you came up with the name Pansy Division.
It was a complete accident. I was working at Rough Trade Distribution, which was a wholesale independent record distributor in San Francisco. And the left side of my desk was against a wall. And on that wall was a bulletin board. And Rough Trade distributed releases, and Rough Trade label put things out. So there was a list of upcoming titles that were being distributed. And one of them was a band whose record never came out because Rough Trade went bankrupt, called Third Panzer Division. I don't know what kind of music it was. I think it might have been electronic. So I could see the bulletin board out of the corner of my eye, because it was to my left. If I'd look forward, I wouldn't see it. But out of the corner of my eye to the left, I would just glance at it, and I thought I saw the phrase Pansy Division instead of Panzer Division. And I thought, Pansy Division? That was right when I needed a name for this gay rock thing that I was contemplating doing. And I thought, wow, that's a really good name. I thought, well, I'm going to hold on to that until I think of something better. But I was satisfied with that pretty quickly. I heard the phrase pansy. It really wasn't used where I lived as a put-down. But it was on Monty Python. And Monty Python, you know, that's how they would refer to the gays, as, you know, pansies, you bleeding pansy. And I thought, I like that, pansy.
What did you want the band Pansy Division to be?
I wanted it to be blunt, unapologetic, and in your face, because I'd moved to San Francisco and had gotten involved with ACT UP and Queer Nation, especially with ACT UP. I was pretty active for a couple of years. And what that showed me was, it showed me a lot of possibilities, including the idea that a bunch of activists and radicals out on the edge making a lot of noise and being to some people unreasonable were able to create a lot of space in society for other people to kind of follow in step behind them. People who don't want to be the first to draw all this attention. But once somebody else is able to make that point, they're able to be there and agree and build on that. I saw from ACT UP how effective that could be. The experience of being involved with those queer activist groups made me think I could do something that was musical, but was still, instead of being like a political activist, I would be a cultural activist. I wanted to sing about sex because I thought sex really hadn't been talked about in and celebrated in a direct way. It's always couched in terms of something else. I thought, I will be blunt. I will be out. It's the time of AIDS, the time of Jesse Helms and right-wing people attacking gays, saying we're monsters. And I thought, instead of trying to placate those people, and who really couldn't be placated anyway, I would just try to be as out and as direct and unapologetic as I could be. I thought, that will be something that I think I can do that nobody else is doing.
Not a lot of people know that before Pansy Division, the band, released its first album, Undressed, in 1993, John, on his own, had recorded a tape, also called Undressed, sold mostly in San Francisco record stores. It had the exact same track listing as the recording that came out later. He got some friends to help him out on the other instruments, but really, there was no band. This was several months before he put an ad in local papers and found Chris Freeman. So I want to play for you the almost demo version of Femme in a Black Leather Jacket and get John to first tell us about the song.
I had the idea to do a gay band, and I thought, well, this is what I want to do. What am I going to sing about? And Femme in a Black Leather Jacket was the first thing that I wrote. It was the first song that I wrote for Pansy Division. It turned out to be one of our best songs. It's actually a composite about several people. It was just about a kind of guy that I liked. I had always thought, even with Pansy Division or The Outnumbered, my previous band, that I wanted to write a song that I could listen to that I felt like nobody else had done before. And that's what that song was for me. I thought, what can I sing about? How can I sing about this that is different that I can't pull a record out from my record collection and say, ah, this satisfies that feeling. So that was my first impulse to write about desire in a uncensored way with the pronouns being correct.
So how did people react to your in-your-face sexual lyrics?
In San Francisco, pretty damn well. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I went over really well from the beginning. And I remember the second show I did was a benefit for Queer Nation. This is when it was just me. I didn't have a band yet, but I was calling it Pansy Division. Just me and my electric guitar. And I played this benefit, and all the dykes left the room. Which I was pretty disappointed that kind of cleared the room of women. So I was very happy that the very next show that I did, my third show, was actually at a queer cabaret called Clubstitute, which is kind of legendary in San Francisco. I was opening for Tribe 8, who I had not heard of. And I think it was their second or third show. And suddenly here were dykes that were right on the same wavelength as me, but they had a whole band. And that was exciting to me. So as after seeing them and sort of, you know, playing a few more months on my own, I thought, all right, time to look for a band.
And as I said, an ad in local papers found him a kindred spirit in Chris Freeman. And with their first of many drummers, they signed with the label Lookout Records and released the first album.
In the film, you and Chris talk about how you didn't expect your audience to be so young.
That is because we ended up on Lookout Records. And Lookout Records had, as a label, a lot of bands that appealed to teenagers. But the style of music we were playing was appropriate for what the Larry Livermore, who started the label, was trying to go for. First album came out, and immediately we started getting letters from teenagers. We thought, okay, we're not aiming at teenagers, we're aiming at people who are like us in our 20s and 30s, because that's how old we were, thinking, okay, it'll be people like us who don't really appreciate the music in the gay scene and have wider variety of tastes than you're supposed to have if you're a homo. So then the record came out on Lookout, and we started getting letters from kids. Not exclusively, but way more than I would have expected. And that was really good, because Chris and I have said many times, the band we started is the band we didn't have when we were teenagers, when we were kids. For us, it's satisfying that people that age can hear it. But that was how we ended up with a younger audience, first thing. Then the second thing was the Green Day tour. So probably before we did the Green Day tour, our audience was, I don't know, 80% gay, 70%. And after we did the Green Day tour, our audience was probably 80% straight, because suddenly there were all these teenagers who discovered us through Green Day and got into our music. And a lot of them thought it was really cool and would write us letters telling how they said, I saw you open for Green Day, I'm straight, but I'm a member of the Gay Straight Alliance at my high school, and I think your music is fantastic. And, you know, it really seemed like we connected with a lot of kids, and that was a wonderful surprise.
Now that we're talking about Green Day, tell us about that whole phenomenon.
We had been on the same label as Green Day, Lookout Records. Their first two albums came out on Lookout. Then they got signed to Reprise Records, Warner Brothers. That first album on the major label came out at the beginning of 94 and was building up, and they were becoming popular. They were catching on. By the time they called us to ask us to open for their summer tour, their first video had gotten on MTV and was really taking off. So when we did the tour, by the time that tour began, which was almost 2 months after they called us, they had gotten huge, and all these places that had been booked were way sold out. Where they could have played, you know, 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 times the size of venues we were playing on that first tour. So they had gotten popular suddenly. They were very loyal to their old label. You know, they'd heard us and thought, all right, here's our opportunity. We're really getting popular. We want to do something that will show people what kind of values, what kind of people that Green Day are. And by having a band like us open for them, made a statement about who they were. It was using the power they had, you know, their sudden popularity, to put us up there on the platform with them and say, here's what we believe in. Having this band on open for us is making a statement. They're a great band, but also they do something unique. I mean, Green Day weren't political particularly then, but a lot of their songs are about personal politics and identity. So we matched well with them, and they were getting bigger and realizing that these kids coming to see them were just treating them like any other band. They're just like, you know, this week's new flavor. And they thought, no, we want to do something to differentiate ourselves from any other new band that's out there. And having Pansy Division opening for them made that statement.
In the film, Matt Wobensmith said the biggest thing in the 90s for the queercore movement was you touring with Green Day.
I think that's true. Matt says this is in the film. People were dismissive of the whole idea of queercore, like in the press. There weren't very many people who were covering us. So the fact that we were suddenly visible in a really mainstream setting made people who might not have written about it or thought it was too insignificant to warrant coverage to suddenly take it seriously and give it a good look.
And pause a moment to tell my listeners who he is.
Matt Wobensmith was the guy who founded Outpunk Records, and he also did Outpunk Magazine. When we decided that we would be the gay band, and, you know, if nobody else wanted to be out, then we would be out. His idea was, well, if there's going to be gay bands, I want to put out their records. So he put out Tribate's first EP and put out a Pansy Division single and started to put out records by other queer bands that were starting to materialize about the same time.
Okay, we've kind of skipped a bit too quickly through the early years of the band, and they released an album a year through 1997, adding to their catalog ones called Deflowered, Pile Up, Wish I'd Taken Pictures, and More Lovin' From Our Oven. I want to cover some of those songs, but I admit, some of the ones I want to play the most, well, you have to go to part two for those. From the list of the ones I can play is one from the Pile Up album from 1995 called I Can't Sleep, which is
About my experiences trying to get laid in San Francisco and how frustrating it could be.
I could turn on my light and read my village voice, but laying next to this beached whale, I haven't got the choice. He looked good at the time,
was God's gift. Selfish and sarcastic, I wanted to take him home, and I got him tortured and groaned. But I can't sleep, I can't sleep. Minutes pass like hours, my eyes open wide, staring up at the ceiling, every pain crack memorized. Think I'll reset my alarm to go off extra early. Wake him up and get him out, try to sleep until 8:30. Being up all night's alright, if it's filled with erotic delight. But I can't sleep, 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 I can't sleep.
And from that same album is one I especially like called Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other.
This is a good story. The writer, Ned Sublette, is from Texas, from West Texas, I think Lubbock. And the song, as I heard it, was actually the second version he recorded. I've never heard the original. I've asked him, but he doesn't want to let it out. It never got released. When he was living in New York in the mid-80s, as part of the new music scene there, he had recorded a very odd version of this song with odd instrumentation. And it had come out on a collection put together by John Giorno, the gay poet from New York, who had a label which used to get arts funding grants called Giorno Poetry Systems. And the Giorno Poetry Systems albums, a lot of it is spoken word. He had William Burroughs, Ann Waldman, Laurie Anderson. He put out these compilations, which would be a combination of spoken word, poetry, and music. And on one of these albums was Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other. And I got it from the Champaign, Illinois Public Library. And I think I got it in like 86. And I loved the song. I just thought it was so good. I had to return the album, so I taped it on a cassette, which I still have. And when we started the band, we did a bunch of covers, usually as the B-sides to singles. A lot of those songs were either songs that I thought were by gay people or suggested that there was a gay meaning to the song. That one was obviously clear. There was nothing hidden. And I thought that was a song that needed to be rescued, plucked off the heap of obscure songs. So I'm really glad to have dragged that one out there. And people hear it and they think, oh, well, that's a song I wrote. But I didn't. The guy who wrote it's a hetero. And he told me that if you stand out as being the least bit creative in West Texas, you're called fag. You're called homo. So he said, you know, because I asked him if he was gay. He said no, but, you know, that's what he was called as a creative kid in an uncreative environment. And so that's what he wrote the song about. I think it's a great song. And Willie Nelson's version, because he does it kind of slower, more waltz style, he omits the final chorus and the second verse. So our version is more complete. But I like Willie's version too. And I think it's great that Willie did it.
There's many strange impulses out on the plains of West Texas. There's many a young boy who feels things he don't comprehend. Well, small towns don't like it when somebody falls between sexes. No, small towns don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men. Well, I believe in my soul that inside every man there's a feminine. And inside every lady there's a deep manly voice loud and clear. Well, a cowboy may brag about things that he does with his women, but the ones who brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer. Cowboys are frequently secretly fond of each other.
visor belts buckle tight. There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels towards his brother. There's many a cowboy who's more like a lady. Says what the others just whisper, and mostly that someone's the first one to get shot down dead. When you talk to a cowboy, don't treat him like he was a sister. Don't mess with a lady that's sleeping in each cowboy's head. Cowboys are frequently secretly fond of each other, even though they take speed and drive pickups and shoot their big guns. There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels towards his brother. There's many a cowboy who keeps quiet about things he's done.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And as I said, this is another one of my shows where I have much too much great material for just 1 hour. So you can find much more on my site, including more of this interview, an interview with G.B. Jones, and several special segments on queercore music. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. We're up to the 1996 album Wish I'd Taken Pictures, and it included an interesting song called Vanilla.
Chris had written James Bondage, and I thought, good, good for you. That was the first song he wrote for the band. I thought as a alternate to James Bondage, I would write Vanilla. Because Chris really wasn't into the things he sings about in James Bondage so much. Vanilla, yeah, that's fairly me.
I've never heard anybody write about that.
Good, then we did something unique.
Sexual favors, but I'm not into those sexual flavors. Sometimes I wish I was braver. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. I know about ropes and whips, handcuffs and nipple slips. That's something I'm gonna skip. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. If I really get into you, maybe I'll sing a different tune. But I'm assuming I'm telling you, I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. Doing bad, whatever pops into their head. The thought of me before planning ahead. It's gotta be mutual, be mutual. So you're into distant swing. It turns you on the more I sing. You're liberal, but fantasize right wing. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla. You'd like some skinhead boy to be your bootlicking bedroom toy. That's fine if it brings you joy. I'm vanilla, I'm vanilla.
Also from Wish I'd Taken Pictures is the song I Really Wanted You.
That song was written and recorded for The Outnumbered. It was on the second Outnumbered album. And it was about a friend of mine who I used to hang out with, who I didn't know if he was gay or not, but who I was quite attracted to. And then one day he told me he had met this woman, and this woman just sort of sunk her claws into him, like, really deeply right away. And I thought, ugh, you know, it's something that I hoped might develop into something for me and him, and then it didn't. So that's kind of a lament.
FM and Howl in the Blues proudly present A Howl in the Heights. Hey, this is the Blues Hound inviting you to join us on Sunday, September 27th at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, located at 1031 East 24th Street in the Heights. This is going to be a special show benefiting your listener-sponsored community radio, 90.1 FM. $10 is going to get you in the door to hear the music of the Space City Aces and the Brad Asher Band. Once again, that's A Howl in the Heights, Sunday, September 27th from 4 to 7. Doors open at 3. Come on, get off the porch and run with the big dogs. Ow! KPFT Houston.
In keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
I'm Bill Crozier, a candidate for the KPFT local station board. Imagine people at work or school talking about a station that dares to speak the truth about unchecked corporate power and influence in Congress and the state government. Imagine your friends telling each other about news and issues that are never covered on TV. Imagine them getting excited about local musicians who they've never heard on any commercial station. KPFT can help turn the tide for peace and justice, but only when more people know about it. We must work together to reach more listeners so we can make our station a more influential voice for truth and reason. Will you help us in this by telling your family, coworkers, and online friends about your favorite KPFT programs? Let's make KPFT known as the place for uncensored news, music, and public affairs in our area. I'm Bill Crozier, and I thank you for supporting our station for peace.
That was a statement by Bill Crozier. Let your voice be heard with your vote. This is KPFT Houston.
Black leather jacket, he's a gem. black leather jacket, he's a fan. In a black leather jacket, and I wanna take him home with me. He's a fan. In a black leather jacket, he's a gem. In a black leather jacket, he's a fan. In a black leather jacket, and I'm gonna take him home with me. I'm gonna take him home with me. I'm gonna take him home with me.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT, and the song I open with is by one of my favorite bands, Pansy Division. It's from their first album from 1993 called Undressed, and the song is Femme in a Black Leather Jacket. I'm very pleased this month because I get to share with you a special interview I did with John Cinoli, the founder of Pansy Division. And he's been very busy lately. The band has just released their 9th full-length album, and it's called That's So Gay. And a new documentary has been hitting the film festival circuit called Pansy Division, Life in a Gay Rock Band. That's out on DVD now. And John's written a book called Deflowered, My Life in Pansy Division. So he's been traveling the country on a book tour. I'm very glad he stopped in Houston, as he was able to come by for an extensive interview. Let me tell you how this show will be set up. My interview with John will be split into two parts, with a lot of it being in part one, the segment designed for broadcast radio. But if you know anything about this band at all, you already know that most of the joy of their music comes from the boundaries they've always gleefully leaped over. Their music celebrates gay sexuality, and they were one of the first to do so with such explicit lyrics. Many of their songs, well, I can't even read the titles on this show. That's where part two will come in. That can be found on my website as an internet-only version. Of course, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. But wait, there's more. In preparation of this show, I also decided that on QMH, I've never really done justice to the punk music genre of queercore. And the main reason why is the same one that's prevented me from playing very many Pansy Division songs over the years. It's the lyrics, folks. So as long as I'm extending this show to the internet, I'm going to attempt the very daunting task of covering the genre of queercore, focusing mostly on the early 90s. I'll finally play such bands as Team Dresch, Tribe 8, Fifth Column, Go, God Is My Co-Pilot, Fag Bash, and on, about 5 hours worth. And if you've ever dug into queercore at all, you've heard of JD's Top 10 Homocore Hits. You'll hear about that as well, because in this special segment, I have a very interesting interview with G.B. Jones, who is credited with being one of the first influences on queercore, both for her work with the fanzine JD's and in the band Fifth Column. So hold on to your seatbelts when you visit those segments. But let's get started with my John Cinoli interview. Pansy Division was not John's first band. For several years in the mid-80s, John led a band called The Outnumbered.
I had wanted to be in a band, have a band since I was a kid. So throughout college, I had the idea of wanting to do a band. And as college was finishing up, I finally started writing songs, and I think I was 20, I started playing guitar and writing songs. So The Outnumbered was my first band, with, you know, all the ideas of my childhood, my youth, building up, thinking, you know, what would I finally do if I got to have a band? So that was my first band. We were in Champaign, Illinois, and the band was successful. We were together 5 years. We made 3 albums and a single. We played over 200 shows and went all over the country. The Outnumbered was, you know, started when I was 22 years old, and it broke up when I was 27. And I just listened to a lot of The Outnumbered's music again recently and just thought, wow, this is the music of a disillusioned young man who just got out of college. It's the Reagan era. And things pretty much seemed to suck. I was working at Kinko's. I wanted to try to play music. The music scene just seemed, you know, mainstream music scene just seemed really dispiriting, really horrible. So I thought, well, I guess I'm just, you know, an outcast. And here's me doing my music, and I'm just going to do it the way I want it to.
I want to stop and ask about one of the songs by The Outnumbered called I Feel So Sorry Now.
Yeah. That was actually the first really good song I wrote. And it really wasn't about anybody in particular. It was just thinking about various things. Thinking about what a relationship would be like and a situation I might find myself in. But it really wasn't written from experience.
Was that the basis for Homo Christmas?
A variation of that is what I used for the music for Homo Christmas, yes. Because I wrote Homo Christmas in a hurry, and it was right before Christmas of 91. And we were going to play a show. It was the week before Christmas, and that afternoon I decided I wanted to write a Christmas song just for the show. And it turned out to be a really good song, but I stole from myself to get the music in a hurry because I had to do it right then.
We'll hear Homo Christmas on part two of this interview. But here's a bit of the song it grew from, I Feel So Sorry Now. The band Outnumbered released three albums. That was from their first, from 1985, called Why Are All the Good People Going Crazy? I know this is a very well-known fact, but this is a history show. I can't not ask how you came up with the name Pansy Division.
It was a complete accident. I was working at Rough Trade Distribution, which was a wholesale independent record distributor in San Francisco. And the left side of my desk was against a wall, and on that wall was a bulletin board, and Rough Trade distributed releases, and Rough Trade label put things out. So there was a list of upcoming titles that were being distributed, and one of them was a band whose record never came out because Rough Trade went bankrupt, called Third Panzer Division. I don't know what kind of music it was. I think it might have been electronic. So I could see the bulletin board out of the corner of my eye, because it was to my left. If I'd look forward, I wouldn't see it. But out of the corner of my eye to the left, I would just glance at it, and I thought I saw the phrase Pansy Division instead of Panzer Division. And I thought, Pansy Division? That was right when I needed a name for this gay rock thing that I was contemplating doing. And I thought, wow, that's a really good name. I thought, well, I'm going to hold on to that until I think of something better. But I was satisfied with that pretty quickly. I heard the phrase pansy. It really wasn't used where I live as a put-down, but it was on Monty Python. And Monty Python, you know, that's how they would refer to the gays, as, you know, pansies, you bleeding pansy. And I thought, I like that, pansy.
What did you want the band Pansy Division to be?
I wanted it to be blunt, unapologetic, and in your face, because I'd moved to San Francisco and had gotten involved with ACT UP and Queer Nation, especially with ACT UP. I was pretty active for a couple of years. And what that showed me was, it showed me a lot of possibilities, including the idea that a bunch of activists and radicals out on the edge, making a lot of noise and being to some people unreasonable, were able to create a lot of space in society for other people to kind of follow in step behind them. People who don't want to be the first to draw all this attention, but once somebody else is able to make that point, they're able to be there and agree and build on that. I saw from ACT UP how effective that could be. The experience of being involved with those queer activist groups made me think I could do something that was musical, but was still, instead of being like a political activist, I'd be a cultural activist. I wanted to sing about sex because I thought sex really hadn't been talked about in and celebrated in a direct way. It's always couched in terms of something else. I thought, I will be blunt. I will be out. It's the time of AIDS, the time of Jesse Helms and right-wing people attacking gays, saying we're monsters. And I thought, instead of trying to placate those people, and who really couldn't be placated anyway, I would just try to be as out and as direct and unapologetic as I could be. I thought that will be something that I think I can do that nobody else is doing.
Not a lot of people know that before Pansy Division, the band, released its first album, Undressed, in 1993, John, on his own, had recorded a tape, also called Undressed, sold mostly in San Francisco record stores. It had the exact same track listing as the recording that came out later. He got some friends to help him out on the other instruments, but really, there was no band. This was several months before he put an ad in local papers and found Chris Freeman. So I want to play for you the almost demo version of Femme in a Black Leather Jacket and get John to first tell us about the song.
I had the idea to do a gay band, and I thought, well, this is what I want to do. What am I going to sing about? And Femme in a Black Leather Jacket was the first thing that I wrote. It was the first song that I wrote for Pansy Division. It turned out to be one of our best songs. It's actually a composite about several people. It was just about a kind of guy that I liked. I had always thought, even with Pansy Division or The Outnumbered, my previous band, that I wanted to write a song that I could listen to that I felt like nobody else had done before. And that's what that song was for me. I thought, what can I sing about? How can I sing about this that is different, that I can't pull a record out from my record collection and say, ah, this satisfies that feeling. So that was my first impulse to write about desire in a uncensored way, with the pronouns being correct.
How did people react to your in-your-face sexual lyrics?
In San Francisco, pretty damn well. I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I went over really well from the beginning. And I remember the second show I did was a benefit for Queer Nation. This is when it was just me. I didn't have a band yet, but I was calling it Pansy Division. Just me and my electric guitar. And I played this benefit, and all the dykes left the room. Which I was pretty disappointed that kind of cleared the room of women. So I was very happy that the very next show that I did, my third show, was actually at a queer cabaret called Clubs de Two, which is kind of legendary in San Francisco. I was opening for Tribe 8, who I had not heard of. And I think it was their second or third show. And suddenly here were dykes that were right on the same wavelength as me, but they had a whole band. And that was exciting to me. So as after seeing them and sort of, you know, playing a few more months on my own, I thought, all right, time to look for a band.
And as I said, an ad in local papers found him a kindred spirit in Chris Freeman, and with their first of many drummers, they signed with the label Lookout Records and released the first album.
In the film, you and Chris talk about how you didn't expect your audience to be so young.
That is because we ended up on Lookout Records, and Lookout Records had, as a label, a lot of bands that appealed to teenagers. But the style of music we were playing was appropriate for what the Larry Livermore, who started the label, was trying to go for. First album came out, and immediately we started getting letters from teenagers. We thought, okay, we're not aiming at teenagers, we're aiming at people who are like us in our 20s and 30s, because that's how old we were, thinking, okay, it'll be people like us who don't really appreciate the music in the gay scene and have wider variety of tastes than you're supposed to have if you're a homo. So then the record came out on Lookout and we started getting...
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Keeping with KPFT's mission of bringing the voices of the community to you, here is one of your candidates in the upcoming election for local station board.
I'm Bill Crozier, a candidate for the KPFT local station board. Imagine people at work or school talking about a station that dares to speak the truth about unchecked corporate power and influence in Congress and the state government. Imagine your friends telling each other about news and issues that are never covered on TV. Imagine them getting excited about local musicians who they've never heard on any commercial station. KPFT can help turn the tide for peace and justice, but only when more people know about it. We must work together to reach more listeners so we can make our station a more influential voice for truth and reason. Will you help us in this by telling your family, coworkers, and online friends about your favorite KPFT programs? Let's make KPFT known as the place for uncensored news, music, and public affairs in our area. I'm Bill Crozier, and I thank you for supporting our station for peace.
That was a statement by Bill Crozier. Let your voice be heard with your vote. This is KPFT Houston.
DIA presents Connect and Communicate, a seminar for South Asian teens, young adults, and parents on forming healthy relationships on Saturday, August 29th, 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at University Center, University of Houston, main campus. Presenters include professionals from Child Builders, a Houston organization promoting positive social and emotional development in children, Montgomery County's Women's Center, and Saheli Austin. The highlight of the seminar will be an interactive theater performance by Gita Kaulagi and Voices Against Violence, UT Austin. The group will demonstrate the day's themes, such as communication techniques, overt and covert messages, power and control issues affecting relationships, cultural conflicts, and...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.